Peter King here, reminding you to subscribe and listen to all new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Peter King, as well as the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer and the 10 Things MMQB podcast.
The second Sunday of the NFL season is in the books. No Teddy Bridgewater, now no Adrian Peterson, but those all-new Vikings win anyway. In Foxborough, we saw the end of the Jimmy Garoppolo era and the start of the Jacoby Brissett era. The Steelers shine in the rain, a very bad day for everyone's preseason darlings, and an officiating embarrassment in Cleveland. All of that and much, much more on the MMQB 10 Things podcast.
The MMQB presents the MMQB 10 Things podcast, powered by digital media. Find your voice. And now, your hosts, Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
Hello and welcome to the MMQB 10 Things podcast. I am Gary Gramling. I'm here with Andy Benoit, and we are going to run down everything important that happened in week two, and then we're going to tell you what it all means. And if our title were a little more honest, we'd probably call this show At Least 10 Things Podcast. Andy, week two, second weekend is done. Are things starting to make a little more sense to you in this 2016 NFL season?
Absolutely, because in week one, I always feel so exposed, so naked out there because I haven't seen anything yet. I haven't seen the film on anybody, and that's now been rectified. I feel very good. It took me all of last week, so I haven't done anything but football, but that's probably why I feel good. And yeah, I'm ready to go. It's mid-season form now.
Well, if you're a Vikings fan who is just coming out of a two-week coma, there's lots of news for you. Sam Bradford is your best player. Teddy Bridgewater is out. Now Adrian Peterson, pretty major knee injury it looks like. We'll get more information as the week rolls on, but this is suddenly Sam Bradford's team, and they looked pretty good against the Packers last night, winning their home opener, new place there for the Vikings, playing indoors unlike the frigid cold of Minnesota last year. But Andy, what did you see from this game specifically from Sam Bradford?
Well, he attacked at the deep and intermediate levels, which is critical because, that, frankly, that's what you did not get with Teddy Bridgewater. And the Vikings will say all the right things about Bridgewater, and they'll believe him. They really like him there. Mm-hmm. But I think people who are a little more distant from it, that just watch this team on film and understand the history of Norv Turner's offense, and they don't know Bridgewater personally, they don't see all the hard work he puts in, I think those people looked at it and said, this guy, Bridgewater, is a hindrance to the offense because it's a vertical offense. Norv Turner does everything vertically. He's very aggressive. I've always used the example, a typical route that might go 15 yards in one system, oftentimes it'll go 17 or 18 yeah. yards in Turner's. Yeah. Everything's just a little stretched. And you've got to be willing to attack windows downfield if you play that way. And Bradford, especially targeting Stephon Diggs, as people saw, I thought mm-hmm. he looked very, very good on Sunday night in that capacity. And against a Packers defense, that's not necessarily easy to look good in that way against.
Yeah. Yeah, he and Stephon Diggs look like they have something very nice cooking up there. Yeah, I just want to reiterate, I want to pat myself on the back and say I never lost hope in Sam Bradford. And now I'm going to exaggerate and just say he's going to be a star now at this point.
Well, that's what shows like this are for. I feel a little bad. I feel bad because I didn't give Bradford enough credit for the second half of the season he had in Philadelphia. I actually, Alan Oy, my film charter, who goes through and charts formations and plays for me on certain projects, I had him do all of Bradford's passes in Philadelphia last season, and there were two quarterbacks. There was Sam Bradford in the first half of the season and Sam Bradford in the second half, and the mm-hmm. comfort level was so startling in every nuanced statistical category that I feel like maybe I shortchanged him, which, in other words, I got him wrong. Now, it's early. It's one game. We'll see. Nobody's seen him in this system yet on film. That offensive line's a little bit of an issue, I think. They are not an athletic group at all. Matt Khalil's a liability at left tackle. The guards are not athletic, and they're going to be vulnerable not just to good pass rushers like your Clay Matthews, but to stunts and twists and certain blitzes where they're going to be forced to redirect and pick up guys on the move. They're going to have to move laterally at some point, and the more teams see them struggle like that, the more it's going to become an issue. And then I don't know if we talk about Adrian Peterson being out. We don't know the extent of it yet, so we probably want to steer clear of that. But it's not all roses here in Minnesota. It's a great way to open the stadium. And the stadium looked very good, too, didn't it? Didn't the lighting look good to you? It looked
I was going to say, for that price tag, it should look good.
Yeah, well, there you go. But, hey, it's a one-week-at-a-time type of league, and the Vikings went in and beat a division opponent. What did you think of Green Bay Sunday night?
You know, Aaron Rodgers still just a little bit shaky. I mean, he's a guy who always, you know, he throws off his back foot. He throws, you know, from weird platforms. He throws off balance. And for years and years, those throws are always on target. And he's missing throws that don't seem to be terribly difficult throws. And I'm not sure what to make of that.
I thought his week one film was, there were three quarterbacks in week one that I thought were jaw-dropping, off the charts, unbelievable. And I'll reveal the other two as we go along here to kind of build the moment. But one of those guys was Aaron Rodgers. And I know he had only 199 yards against Jacksonville, but he made those kind of throws that you just talked about, Gary. And the results were positive, and they were indefensible. Like, literally, you couldn't defend some of them. They were such perfect throws, and they were mechanically incorrect throws, which he does. Yeah, you throw out all of the quarterbacking rule book with Aaron Rodgers because his arm talent is so unique. But you're right. They didn't. Those throws weren't connecting the next night. It looks like the route combinations weren't really there again. There were a lot of isolation patterns from what we could see on the TV copy. You don't see everything on TV, of course. But the chemistry with Jordy Nelson's not there. Nelson's not the same guy yet, and we don't know how long it'll take him to get comfortable. A lot of the questions we've had about Green Bay, it seemed like they resurfaced a little bit again in this game. They were there last week as well, but Rodgers was so incredible it offset them. And now we're seeing, they look like, to me, this just on Sunday night, they look like the Packers of 2015, and that's not a good thing.
It's not. There was a whole lot of Devontae Adams last night, and that's not necessarily a good thing. And look, from the Vikings' perspective, still figuring out on offense and still have some questions to answer depending on Peterson's status, but Adrian Peterson has 31 carries for 50 yards through two games, and the Vikings are 2-0, so strange things going on in the NFC North. Let's move on to topic two. That is what went down in Washington. Cowboys show up, seem to open things up a little bit more for Dak Prescott after going pretty conservative in week one in a loss to the Giants. They did some things on offense, and we'll start, both teams did things on offense, some of them good, and on the other side, a lot of them bad, but we'll start with the Dallas guys. Do you like what you saw from Prescott today? I think it's, you know, they got the ball to Dez Bryant. You know, they figure out how to, I don't know, have a fully functioning offense with a rookie quarterback, which they didn't have it last week.
I think Dak Prescott plays on time in the pocket, and in any time that from an inexperienced quarterback, that's a positive because that takes experience, and so that's, if you have it when you're inexperienced, you could say that might be one of those things you can't teach. That's quarterbacking instincts. So if Dak Prescott can play that way, it's real important still, I think, that they play on schedule with him, which means we talk about Dallas's running game, and it was a little bit more effective against Washington than it was against the Giants. The Giants' D-line really outplayed the Cowboys. Washington's not known for their D-line necessarily. I think you're 1-for-2 here so far, offensive performance with Dallas, which would make sense. That's their record's 1-1. I think they've had an average showing, and then they had the type of showing that you need in order to survive these weeks without Tony Romo.
All right, Washington's defense. You know, I want to back up to last offseason when they got Josh Norman and our Emily Kaplan. You can hear her, by the way, on the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer. Comes out Tuesdays, but Emily Kaplan did a piece with Josh Norman, spent a day with him in Washington, and Norman, to me, was strongly hinting that Washington had basically told him, you know, you can follow number ones here. You can play some man, you can follow number ones, because he was saying how, you know, the trash talk of choice against Josh Norman when he was in Carolina was that you're a zone corner, you're a cover two corner, you know, you can't be a shutdown guy, you're just a system guy. And through two games, you know, they got him on the one side of the field, and everyone's picking on Breland on the other side. I mean, does Joe Barry change this, or is this just who the Redskins are going to be this year?
Well, let's clear a few things up. First of all, I would be surprised if Washington told him you can play man-to-man here, because Washington played more zone than any defense in the league last season. That's their MO. That's what they're made up of.
Yep.
And Josh Norman's a zone corner. That's why they felt comfortable paying him. Now, Carolina used Norman as a number one corner. They did have him follow number ones when they aligned outside. They had other guys play the slot in Carolina. But anytime your number one receiver was on the perimeter, Norman oftentimes was with him. They're not doing that in Washington, so that's the discussion. Washington's answer to it is that it's not just Norman that impacts. That impacts a lot of guys around him. Breland has to play both sides now. What does it mean for the safeties, and what does it mean for some of the keys and reads? I mean, there's other factors with it. That's their argument. Whether I buy it or not, look, they know their players better. Breland's not a bad NFL cornerback, though.
Yeah.
He's not as – you agree?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, he's not as good as Antonio Brown is as a receiver, and he's not as good of a cornerback as Dez Bryant is as a receiver. So he's gotten some bad matchups, which in theory is what Norman's here to offset, is Norman's the guy that can take away the bad matchup. So I understand why people are not happy with it. And if you have such a simple defense like Washington does, and it's a simple zone scheme, the idea is for everyone to be able to play fast and at their fastest. And I would think having the number one receiver facing your number one corner, ultimately that's going to help everyone else play faster. Breland's going to play faster against Marcus Wheaton, who I know didn't play in week one, but just in theory, Marcus Wheaton, the number two Steelers receiver, he'll play faster against that guy, against Terrence Williams, than he would against Antonio Brown or Dez Bryant.
Yeah. Yeah. Washington.
But Gary, you know what else? I'm sorry, Gary, but Seattle for so many years has played Richard Sherman on one side of the field.
Yes.
And nobody says anything. No one says, oh, well, why doesn't Richard Sherman follow number ones? And he does in certain critical moments, but for the most part, he's the left cornerback. And I think the one difference between Seattle and Washington is Richard Sherman is surrounded by about seven or eight other guys who are top five at their position around the league. That's a defense full of superstars. And so there isn't a Breshad Breland across from him. Now, maybe there is this year with Deshaun Shedd. He's okay, but he's not Byron Maxwell. But there's not Earl Thomas in midfield. There's not Cam Chancellor at strong safety, Bobby Wagner at the shallow part of midfield. Mm-hmm. So it's not offsetting the stationariness of Richard Sherman so much. And maybe so the solution is you can play a corner on one side of the field, but you've got to have other guys around him in order to play that way. Otherwise, you're just kind of casting your guy away, because if they throw away from Norman, that's not necessarily good for you like it is if they throw away from Sherman, because if you throw away from Sherman, you're still throwing at a lot of other good Seahawk defenders who now have less field to defend.
Yeah, absolutely. But I couldn't wait.
Do you think it changes? Do you think they'll change this?
Do I think they'll change it? I do not.
You think especially they'll go 16 games like this?
Yeah. I mean, who's coming up? I don't think they'll have him shadowing Odell Beckham. I think the Giants will move around Beckham enough that that it won't really be an option anyway. And, you know, what, Dez comes through again? I don't know. You know, if you were going to do it, you do it with Antonio Brown. You do it with Dez Bryant. And if you didn't do it in those two games, I mean, you know, No real reason to change course now.
You're 0-2 with that formula now, though, and you've lost two games at home, and you've gotten both of those guys, those receivers, have had 100 yards plus against you easily. So you don't think they change it? It seems like if they don't move, let's say they don't move Norman around when Beckham comes to town. When does Beckham come to town? Do we know that? It's
I'll bring it up right now. He comes to town in next week. They go
there
to New York. So
yeah, we're
there
on top
go.
Of it right there next week.
There you go.
So he goes to New York on the big stage. He doesn't shadow Beckham, and Beckham has a big game. Don't you think this becomes like the biggest talking thing in the NFL, a huge distraction? It becomes that weird ultimate headline story of 2016 so far, assuming that the discontent about their quarterback, which I know we're going to talk to in a second, assuming that doesn't trump it?
Maybe, but then you know, they don't face another top-notch receiver until the October 30th, AJ Green. I don't know. I think the way that the Giants can move Beckham into the slot and play him there, that's what they did a lot against the Panthers last year. I don't know. I don't think there's a reason to panic if this is the way the Redskins were going to play their defense. I think they just stick with it, and you know, everything will work itself out when you get Cleveland in town and go to Baltimore and those Eagles receivers. I mean, those are those are teams you can do that against, and you don't really have to change what you originally planned on doing.
By the way, I don't think the Giants would be that hesitant to put Beckham across from Norman, assuming Beckham doesn't lose his mind this time. Beckham, last year, he had a drop early in the game, so that took away one of them, but there were instances where he ran by Norman.
He
beat him that game, but the plays weren't made, so Norman came away with the advantage, as he should. But Beckham... Norman cannot run with Josh Beckham, and I don't think the Giants will avoid Norman the way people would guess they might.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting. We'll find out in a couple days here. Yeah, Washington's going to New York for that one. But I wanted to hit the other side of the coin, Andy, with Washington, which is rumblings that they're upset with Kirk Cousins, that players are saying they're disappointed with his play, his decision-making. He had that crippling interception on Sunday. He had a bad one against the Steelers, too, but obviously that was not a make-or-break type of play. They were going to lose that game regardless. But is it time to worry about Kirk Cousins? I know this time last year you were thinking Colt McCoy might actually be the best quarterback on that roster.
Well, I thought that going into last year because I thought we'd see this version of Kirk Cousins a year ago. And then that was correct. That proved wrong. Kirk Cousins was very good for them in the second half of the season, and he wasn't god-awful in the first half. It's a system there in Washington. I've said this a lot. Kirk Cousins is a puzzle piece and an extremely well-designed puzzle. And so if he doesn't play well, it's going to feel glaring to guys because the system's going to work more often than not. The systems, the way they're designed, they out-leverage the coverage, and players understand which routes beat which coverages. And so there's a lot of shoulds around. Hey, I should be open. This should be me. They know who should be getting the ball because the play design dictates that. It's not like in Green Bay where everyone's kind of running their own routes and, hey, I'm beating my man, don't you see it that way as well? It's not an interpretation thing in theory. Mm-hmm. It's less of an interpretation thing. So I understand how there could in theory be rumblings. The Ryan Shazier interception that you touched on, okay, maybe it didn't swing the game, but just as a concept, that's the kind of play that does get guys to raise their eyebrows in the film room, because that was as basic of a cover three as you're going to see. And cover three is the most common coverage in the NFL, and it's the Steelers' most common coverage, and there was nothing tricky about it, and Cousins flat out made the wrong throw and the wrong decision, and it's hard to explain that one. If you can explain the plays, it's a little better because things go wrong. But that was the kind of throw that Cousins would make a few years ago that would get him benched. And it's one play, but it's emblematic of the kind of stuff that could be going on. I don't know if this story – look, the story goes away if Washington wins, but you're 0-2 at home. You're facing a 2-0 team on the road next week. Yep. This story could also dig its heels in.
Yep. We'll see. We will find out in a couple days. All right, let's move on to topic number three. Steelers looking very, very good. Both sides of the ball, they held A.J. Green to two catches on Sunday after Green had that monster game against Revis and the Jets. Offensively, I think this is what everyone kind of expected, what they do, just not necessarily with the people they have right now. Le'Veon Bell suspended, Martavis Bryant obviously out for the year. They were missing Marcus Wheaton on Sunday. So, you know, it's Roethlisberger, it's Antonio Brown, D'Angelo Williams is wonderful. But, you know, some new faces in there. Sammy Coates, a couple big plays. Eli Rogers, offensive line is churning out the yards. And this one could have gotten out of hand. They were playing in the rain. There was an early interception by Roethlisberger, a little post route by Antonio Brown. it was going to be a touchdown. The ball slipped out of Roethlisberger's hands, ends up being thrown about 5 yards behind Brown, which just happened to be where Adam Jones was at the time, so turns into an interception. But the Steelers, other than that, pretty close to flawless in beating the Bengals and sort of taking the early upper hand in the AFC North.
I think the story is the defense. 16 points allowed 2 weeks in a row against two of the better designed offenses in the league. Kind of similar offenses, actually. In fact, Jay Gruden from Washington, of course, comes from Cincinnati. And so in Cincinnati, they always promote from within. So they're sticking with the same offensive philosophy year after year. And so maybe that's part of it. But the Steelers' defense, and I haven't seen the film on this one yet, and the film's important with Pittsburgh because of how much the coverages influence the rest of what they do. The Steelers' defense, though, in week one did not do their blitzes against Washington. They lined up and just played and outplayed those guys. As the season goes along, they're going to get more complex schematically because that's just the nature of this coaching staff. It's the Steelers' coaches are almost all former Steelers themselves, former Steeler players, all of them. And they know the system in and out, and they know all the nuances of it and fully believe in it because they played in it. And there's always this inspiration to let's push it a little further. Let's get our young guys to know a little bit more. Mm-hmm. And Keith Butler, their coordinator, did not feel he didn't feel comfortable with all of that last season. He thought the young guys were a little too young. Butler doesn't feel that way this year. And so at some point, we're going to see the full chess match side of Pittsburgh mixed with these younger, faster players that they have. Your Ryan Shazier's, your Jarvis Jones's, even to a certain degree, your Stephen Tuitt's and Cameron Hayward's, all these guys. I think the Steelers' defense will continue to get better as the season goes on.
Yeah. I saw our buddy Artie Burns out there. He got beat on touchdown.
Remind me why Artie Burns is our buddy.
Because we get to say Boo Earns when we talk about him.
Oh, okay. The Simpsons from 10 years before most of our audience remembers them. Yeah. I got you.
Weirdly enough, Andy Dalton, it was supposed to be that sort of more ball control Bengals offense this year, threw for 366 for a second straight game, although this time it took him 54 attempts to get to that 366. But yeah, Steelers, early upper hand in the AFC North. Now let's go on to topic four, the Jimmy Garoppolo era, perhaps already coming to an end. He goes down with a shoulder injury. It is a sprained AC joint in that right shoulder. That's his throwing shoulder. He'll almost surely not play on Thursday. It looks like it is time for Jacoby Brissett, the rookie third-round pick out of NC State, and a mentee. Is that how you'd say a mentor's student?
Yep,
mentee.
It is. But who's he the mentee of?
Bill Parcells.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's not bad.
Yeah, so that's how he got linked up with the Patriots. Well, I'm sure for other reasons as well. But, you know, watching that Patriots offense, I don't know. I kind of get the sense that maybe I could run it. Because it seems like no matter what happens, there's, you know, you got Martellus Bennett standing, you know, with no one wide open with no one within 10 yards of him. Or, you know, it's Danny Amendola sort of just running up the seam with a cornerback, you know, 3 yards behind them. It just seems like everything they do is just coming so easily. And I don't know if it's just, you know, the play calling acumen of Josh McDaniels or, you know, if these guys are really, you know, sort of grasping it this easily there. But whatever's happening in New England, they are just not really missing a beat, at least early on. They already have their two wins in the non-Brady portion of the schedule.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
People, you know, it was sort of like, well, way. if they before the season, it was kind of like, well, if they go 2-2 without Brady,
yep,
you know,
that's
pretty good. So here we are, 2-0 without Brady.
What Miami did to them, and when Garoppolo was in, Miami plays a lot of basic zone coverages. That's going to be their MO this year as well. That's kind of the theme of the show so far. Washington's more of a cover three. Miami's more of a cover two or cover four, meaning they keep two safeties back instead of one safety. It's all interchangeable, but you get more of that with Miami. Garoppolo, it's interesting because remember we talked last week about Arizona and how they played so many just vanilla zone-type coverages. Mm-hmm. And we wondered if Arizona didn't trust their cornerbacks or not, and why did they play that way? we kind of got the answers in all directions. For one, I don't think, and Garoppolo's out now, so it's academic, but I don't think you're going to want to just play basic zone against him because he showed a very good command of that offense. He killed Miami those first three possessions.
He did.
On the side note with Arizona, against Tampa Bay, they were back to their blitzing ways. They benched Brandon Williams and brought in Cooper, but they were Marcus Cooper, the former Chief, but they were blitzing even before that. So clearly they felt the best way to play Garoppolo was to just play zone. It wasn't about who they had. It was about who they were facing. They also must feel it's good to blitz Winston, which it is. But teams are lining up and playing very basic zone against New England, even though New England's without its best players right now, which tells you teams worry about two things with the Patriots. One is the ability to go up tempo, because sometimes they will go no huddle, and you can go up tempo. This ties into item two. You can go up tempo when you have flexible, versatile personnel. If you've got a Martellus Bennett who can play tight end and then split out at wide receiver, you go up tempo because you don't sub, but you can change your formations as if you did substitute. And teams' response to that, they think we're not going to try to match what New England's doing. They throw too much at us, it'll make us play slow. We're just going to line up and play zone and trust that we can out-execute them because they're not going to beat us over the top. That's the thinking.
Yeah.
And that's what maybe you could play quarterback for them, Gary, because you know what coverage you're going to get. If you could learn to read zone coverage and then throw the ball with 6 or 7 yards downfield with discipline, that's good enough to run New England's system in theory. It's harder than that, of course, but that's how they play football. It's a really well-coached offense.
I'm not sure if I could throw a ball 6 or 7 yards, so I'll take it
past. That's like 18 feet. I mean, we forget about the feet part of that.
Yeah, if I can get a running start. Yeah, we'll see.
I don't know if they'll play this way with Brissett, though, because it's a short week. He's got 3 days to prepare for Houston.
Yep.
I assume he didn't get hardly any reps at all because they had to get ready for two starters in training camp. So he hasn't played in the NFL. And when he did come in against Miami, they looked like a really well-put-together high school offense. It was a fullback, sometimes two tight ends on the field, and they handed the ball very basically to LeGarrette Blount.
A lot of LeGarrette Blount.
And he answered the call, too. Well, we'll see if he can do that on short days rest against a much better Texans defense, how fresh he'll be. The point is, Brissett, just because the Patriots played this way, Brissett has never played this way. So I don't know how remedialized the offense will have to be for him, but they'll have to change something.
Yeah, offensive line looks good there in New England. That was a question mark coming in. And, you know, like you said, LeGarrette Blount, he was the closer.
Yeah,
he
when they got Nate Solder back,
if you will.
There you go. They got Nate Solder back at left tackle, and they got Shaq Mason back at guard, too. Is that show that you just referenced, is that still on?
No, but there's a new one. Always see it. You always see it advertised during NBA games.
That's what I remember. I remember the year the Mavericks beat the Warriors, or the other way around, excuse me. The Warriors beat the Mavericks in the first round when the Mavs were the one seed. The closer was on as a preview, and it had that song, Ain't No Sunshine, and that song would get stuck in my head in the previews for days at a time, and it went to 7 games, so that was a lot of previews.
Yeah, I think she moved on, and they just...
It was a 6-game series,
She moved on, and they rebranded the show or something. We'll get a fact check on that and clear it all up when we come back next week. But Patriots, 2-0, without Tom Brady. Jacoby Brissett is in. Let's go on to topic 5. We're going to go to Denver. This was something of a... correct me if I'm wrong, Colts had beaten Denver the last two matchups, right? Going back to the 2014 playoffs when they upset them in Denver, and then they beat them in Indy last year.
Yeah, they did. Denver beat up on them, though. They beat Denver, but Denver took their quarterback out for the season in that game. Not that that was Denver's goal, but it was a game that was not well played by the Colts a year ago. They happened to get the win. It was really a lose-lose, that game was. They could not protect Andrew Luck in that one.
Yeah. Well, we'll touch on Luck in a second, but I just want to ask you what you think of this Denver offense so far. Obviously, they were supplemented by two defensive touchdowns. You had an Aqib Talib pick six, and you had somebody should block Von Miller at some point because he had the strip sack, and Shane Ray with the TD late in the game, which for the betting public, that was a very significant touchdown. But yeah, what do you think of Trevor Siemian, and do you think this Denver offense is going to be enough as the season goes on, assuming the defense isn't basically standing on its head for the next 3 months?
While they've played a team that went to the Super Bowl last year and then a team that the year before went to the championship, and they've beaten them both. And so far the offense has been enough, and the schedule's not going to get much harder than this. Teams will learn more about the offense, I suppose, so maybe it gets harder in that sense. But the offense will also get more time together with Trevor Siemian as well. Simeon's going to be a complimentary player. I know he looked very good in the opener, and so that kind of set the narrative as this darling. What you can't see when we watch these games on TVs are throws that, in theory, should be made and are not attempted.
Yeah.
And that's usually how you tell how comfortable a quarterback is and how they're using him and where he feels his role in the offense is. And Siemian so far has been just a guy in that realm, in that one specific realm. Now, that could shift in the matter of 1 week because the next game will be one-third of his career games. So it's very early to tell on Siemian. But this is a defensive-driven team. There were people that thought the defense wasn't going to be as good this year, and I think the defense, I don't know, could we say that it's reasonable to say the defense is even better this year?
It's weird. They shouldn't be. I mean, Malik Jackson is gone, and Danny Trevathan is gone. They shouldn't be better. But through two games, I don't know if you could really deny that.
You know what's interesting about Von Miller? Is that people, we always hear about left tackles and how important the left tackle is because you protect your quarterback's blind side.
Mm-hmm.
And that started back in the 80s when teams were doing lining up under center and dropping back seven steps and throwing the ball. That now teams are in shotgun and they throw the ball in three-step timing. So the blind side, I think, is inherently less significant. But if you look around the league at all the dangerous pass rushers, they're on the other side. They're the guys that go after your right tackle. It's J.J. Watt plays on that side, Justin Houston when he's healthy, Cliff Averill, Von Miller's over there, Michael Strahan used to play over there. It's JPP's now the guy that's over there for the Giants. Some of the best pass rushers in the NFL come on that other side, and when you rush the passer from that side, and we see this with Von Miller all the time, you're closer to the ball because the quarterbacks are all right-handed. So you get more sack, strip, fumbles in those scenarios as well. And someone at the combine, a coach, made a point to me. We were having this discussion, what positions are most important to you? Like, which would you build around? Do you want a cornerback? What do you want? And he said he wanted a left defensive end, someone that goes against your right tackle because of the things we're talking about, but also because the quarterback can see that guy coming, and he likes the idea of the quarterback seeing the pressure coming because he thinks it impacts the way the quarterback plays.
Yeah, yeah. That makes it
Von
a lot
Miller
of sense.
For you. That's the Von Miller factor. Notice they don't move Miller around either. They have other guys around him so they can get away with it, but they would put Miller wherever they feel is the most important position to them because he's that kind of talent. Clearly, Denver feels that left defensive end or left edge rusher is the most important position, too.
Yep. On that last play, it was kind of like Joe Wright's. That's who you're going to block him with one-on-one.
Sometimes that's all you can do. You can't. Yep. I mean, you don't have other guys. You've got only one right tackle. You can't slide the protection to everybody because that impacts your routes, too. It's hard to play offensive line in the NFL.
Yep. There you go. That's what we're settling on. Andy, before we keep going, I want to tell you about mybookie.net. Football season is here. The action has been great so far, and you're probably settling into a routine. So how do you keep that excitement going? Get in the action and play like the pros at mybookie.net. It's the most exciting online experience for sports fans. MyBookie features real Vegas odds and incredible player props on every football game. Game already kicked off? MyBookie has live in-games with odds updated in real time. It's never too late to make a play. It's optimized for smartphone users for nonstop action on the go. Go online, type MyBookie into your browser, and sign up today. Use promo code 10THINGS, that's 10THINGS, to be entered into their $1 million prize pool. Or call 844-722-2387. Join the thousands of online players already playing. Only the biggest, only the best, only at MyBookie. Sign up today.
This is the MMQB 10 Things Podcast with Andy Benoit and Gary Gramling.
This is Adrian Wojnarowski of The Vertical. For candid conversations with the biggest names around the NBA, be sure to check out our podcast network, which includes The Vertical Podcast with Woj, The Vertical Podcast with J.J. Redick, and The Vertical Podcast with Chris Mannix, all at thevertical.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
All right, Andy, let's jump back into it. Topic six, we are going to go into some disappointing things, namely the two preseason darlings. Everyone loved the Oakland Raiders and the Jacksonville Jaguars coming into the season. Jaguars, you know, kind of shaky in week one, not a terrible result, nothing, no shame in losing to the Packers. They were not competitive in San Diego yesterday, which was especially disappointing since I think we all thought the Chargers didn't have the personnel to really compete after Keenan Allen went down, and they're running out, you know, what is kind of like a CFL type of, you know, skill position group on offense.
Well, yeah, because Danny Woodhead, as I understand, he went down early in that game as well.
He did.
And when Woodhead's out, that really changes the dimension of that team, because that's a single-back, shotgun-style team, and the check-down passing game is a big part of what they do and how they get to it, and Woodhead's the key to that. So to lose to the Chargers badly when they don't have Keenan Allen, they're thin at wide receiver, and they're without Danny Woodhead, that's a horrible loss.
Yeah. Well, didn't really slow down the Chargers. They moved it on Sunday, and that rebuilt Jaguars defense that was supposed to sort of, you know, usher in the new era of the winning Jacksonville Jaguars, that's not working out. And similarly, you know, you go north to Oakland. They hosted the Falcons, gave up another 500 yards of offense. They can't stop anyone. A couple of bad breaks, a couple of deflected passes turned into, you know, one turned into a touchdown, one turned into a key third down conversion late. This game kind of got away from them in the fourth quarter, but I mean, this is not good. This is not good what's going down in Oakland so far, especially on the defensive side of the ball.
They're a zone-based defense, and what the Saints did to them, because the Saints put up huge numbers as well, mm-hmm. The Saints spread out, and when you spread out a zone defense, you isolate the zone defenders. Those guys get stuck on an island. The Falcons are almost the opposite. I don't know how exactly they played the Raiders. I'll have to look at that closer, but the base of their offense is not spreading out. They're a very condensed offense. That's how they're used to playing. So Oakland's gone against a team that liked to spread against them and got killed, and now that defense saw a team that's built to play in a condensed formation, and they again got killed. That's a bad start for that defense, certainly.
Yep. Let's go on to topic seven. The Rams beat the Seahawks again. I guess this shouldn't surprise anyone. No matter how bad the Rams looked on Monday night, you knew they were going to give the Seahawks a game. Swept them last year. Here we are again. L.A., first game since 1994, and they beat them. A field goals only game. And, you know, congratulations to the Rams, and we're not going to delve too deep into them. The defense was excellent. Case Keenum was less Case Keenum-ish this week than he was last Monday night. But the Seattle offensive line looks like it's going to be a major problem again this year. And we talked about it last year, and they had a whole offseason to address it. And here we are again. They might be worse off than they were early last season.
They did get better last year, over the course of the season at least. Yeah. And I think people around the league respect Tom Cable, their O-line coach. They did address the line, too. They drafted Jermaine Ifedi at guard, who hasn't played yet because of injury. They moved mm-hmm. Justin Britt to center. He's looked okay there. I'm trying to find the silver lining. The rest of it, though, it's you don't have a good athletic left tackle with Bradley Soule. Mark Lewinsky, we wondered about him in the offseason. He hasn't gotten off to a great start. But they've got other guys. They put effort in here. I wouldn't be surprised if we see them reshuffle those as the season goes along. They've been willing to do that in past years.
Yeah, yeah. Russell Wilson was also limited because of the ankle injury. He sort of stayed in a little more often than maybe he would have. And also just, I mean, they got very little going in the run game. Just an ugly game, a nasty, you know, sort of Rams-Seahawks type of game.
Yeah, and shame on all the people that were acting like the Rams were not an NFL team, by the way. Just because they didn't look good, they looked horrible on a national stage, and so we write them off. The Rams are pathetic. They stink. They can't play. This was a team that was around 500 a year ago. It's not like this is a team that wins two games every 5 years.
It's the frustration of seeing a team where, you know, your number one overall pick is on the bench.
Playing.
Because he presumably was outplayed in the preseason by the veteran, and the veteran goes out and I mean, offensively, they were terrible. And that's what people focus on. People see the offense, and they see the lack of production there, and that sort of overshadows everything else that goes on. But
sure.
Because we all play fantasy football. Except for you. You don't play fantasy, do you?
No, I play real football. Watching it. Watching it on a screen, like a man.
All right. Let's go topic 8. We're actually going back in time here. We're going to go to, I guess this was Friday. Greg Roman, fired offensive coordinator in Buffalo, goes down. I have sort of outed myself as a Bills supporter. I don't want to call myself a fan. I'm a journalist, so I don't root for anyone, but I would like to see the Bills. I would like to see the Bills have success. I think it would make a lot of people in my life happy, and a lot of people in Western New York who are wonderful people. It would make them very happy. But sort of the narrative being pushed out was you fire Greg Roman. Oh, you guys just gave up 37 points to the Jets. You gave up 500 something yards. Why does this fall on Roman? I've watched this offense pretty closely for the last, 18 games now. It's just, I think it's too much dependent on, and I made this comparison in my column on Sunday morning. It reminds me of the RG3 Redskins teams, where a lot of their production just came off improvisation and a scramble and a big play. And, you want some sort of consistency. You want an offense that can move the ball when it has to move the ball and not just rely on, we're going to get an 80-yard touchdown once every 7 drives and the other times we'll just go 3 and out because they go 3 and out a ton. And, on top of that, Thursday night, 31 points, 7 of them came from the defense. One was on a broken play scramble that turned into 71 yards. One was Marquise Goodwin running past Darrell Revis. And the last one was, the Jets basically put 10 defenders in the back of the end zone and said, you guys run out the clock with your little drive there. And that was the end of it. But all that said, you probably know this better than me, Andy. Were you caught off guard by the Greg Roman firing?
Yes, because Greg Roman has had a quarterback there who is incredible on throwing the deep ball, Tyrod Taylor. He's one of the best in the league at it, and that's all he can do. That's what he has. He's not an anticipation passer. He doesn't process coverage quickly, which is part of the reason he doesn't anticipate. And some of that's inexperience, and some of that's just that's his style of play. He has to be a runaround sandlot guy. So you're not going to have consistency in the passing game, which means you have to be a running team. And that's why they hired Greg Roman. He was one of the best run designers. He came from Carolina in Cam Newton's early years. He brought a lot of those zone read type principles to San Francisco under Harbaugh when he worked with Harbaugh. They also did a very good job with gap scheme runs, which are pull blocker concepts. So you have zone and man-to-man or gap scheme run blocks. You're very good at it. Last season, they ranked number one in the league in rushing yards and yards per attempt. So they were an efficient running team.
Yeah.
Some of that's having the mobile QB, some of that.
Yeah.
But the point is, you need to play as a run offense. You're a defensive-based team. That's how you want to be with Rex Ryan. Greg Roman was not the problem in Buffalo, and something doesn't quite smell right here. Either there's a hasty decision coming from Rex Ryan, which is uncharacteristic of him, although Anthony Lynn, the guy that he replaced Roman with, he's been with Anthony Lynn a lot of years. He hasn't been with Roman a lot of years, so maybe he felt comfortable. Or
Roman
it's
was,
not Rex's decision. That's the other thing. It could be not Rex's decision.
Yep. I mean, like you said, Roman was not a guy who came from that Jets staff. A lot of the guys on Rex's Bills staff did come with him from New York. So,
and look, if you can run the ball well, it's not the worst thing then to promote your running back coach. People respect Anthony Lynn, so we'll see. But the timing's way off, of course. It is near the worst thing to do it after 2 games into the season.
Yep. Nothing good happening in Buffalo. This is not going to be a good year. So let's move on to topic 9. This is the lightning round. We're going to run through some of the stuff that we just didn't, I don't know, get to cram into the first 8 topics here. Andy, do you want to, we'll say you won the toss. Do you want to receive or do you want to defer?
Receive means I start. Do I say something first?
Yep.
I will receive because I want to make a point about the Dolphins. They're 0-2. Mm-hmm. So people are going to say Adam Gase, so he's not working with Tannehill. You know, he's in over his head, whatever it is, got to get going. Adam Gase's system has worked in Miami so far. It just hasn't produced the results, which ultimately he's got to produce the results. But his play designs, we're seeing the Adam Gase system. It looks like his offense, and they have gone real well. Kenny Stills had the bad drop in week 1. It would have changed the narrative of that game. He's out-schemed his opponents multiple times now, and it's been the Seahawks and Patriots he's gone up against. So I would just say temper your reaction to the Dolphins' 0-2 start. They've also gone on the road against 2 of the 3 or 4 best teams in the league, and they've come close. Exactly. They haven't won. But I wouldn't rule out the Dolphins.
Well, there you go. I'm going did you see this Terrell Pryor taunting penalty?
Yeah, it was horrible. It was crap.
Oh my God.
A bad call.
It was brutal. It was brutal, and it was the difference between there were 21 seconds left. If the flag isn't thrown, they have the ball in the 10. It was thrown, so they actually had offsetting penalties. There was defensive holding on that play, so it was back at the 30. If you didn't see it, and I advise you, you're just going to be enraged if you watch the highlight. Pryor catches the ball on the sideline. I believe it was Lardarius Webb was in coverage, and sort of goes to flip it to the ref, and it's sort of half slips out of his hand and you know, hits Webb on the shoulder or something. And Webb didn't notice it, and Pryor didn't think anything of it. And I think no one even noticed the flag was thrown until they got together and started talking about it. But, yeah, headlinesman Wayne Mackey drops in, just completely takes the game out of the player's hands, and I'm angry. Does my tone...
You're angry about it.
My
so
tone
is Terrell
get
Pryor.
That across?
I was surprised that because if official sees it at his angle, it looked like Pryor did that, and just the way it caught his eye and he throws the flag, he's doing his job. I was surprised the other official who was right there, though, helping spot the ball. I'm surprised he didn't say something. Maybe he didn't see it. It was bizarre. That's the kind of thing that usually gets communicated away and fixed on the fly, and it didn't in this case, and it was a big call.
You got to be 100% sure if you're going to throw a taunting flag there that there was actual taunting going on. But anyways.
Yeah, at that stage of the game, yeah, you're right.
Yeah. What else you got, Andy?
I got Tampa Bay. Remember I said there were 3 QBs in week 1 that were just off the charts, unbelievable?
Mm-hmm.
One of them was Jameis Winston, and that wasn't the case, obviously, in week 2 against the Cardinals. Variety of reasons, but it starts with, and he's not the reason they lost, but for his game personally, it starts with him. Winston didn't throw the ball as well. But I would still just say there's reason to be excited in Tampa because of Winston. I'm still getting over how good he looked in week 1, I guess. And that's the deepest attacking offense in the NFL. No team throws down the field more regularly within the context of their system than does Tampa Bay. And ironically, the number 2 deepest attacking team is the one that got them on Sunday, Arizona.
Yeah, yep. I'm actually going to pair 2 quarterbacks together here. Matthew Stafford, I thought, looked fantastic again on Sunday. The rest of the Lions looked like they were sort of turn back the clock day to 2008 or something like that. I mean, they were the drops. I think it ended up being 7 drops and 17 penalties, and that is how you lose at home to the Titans when your quarterback plays well. On the other side of the coin, Brock Osweiler, he's 2-0 now as the Texans starter. Houston defense is looking absolutely fantastic through 2 games here. Osweiler has his moments, but, I mean, so far, when the ball comes out of his hand, you just don't know where it's going. He has such issues with, I guess you'd say, ball placement. And you know, it was the same thing on Sunday where even wide-open throws, you know, he's got receivers have to go down and scoop him out. And, you know, but every once in a while, he puts something very nicely on a guy, and it's just... He's all over the place, and I don't know how that plays out in the long run because it's kind of what happened with him last year where he was pretty sharp early on and then just got more and more erratic as the year went on.
Well, he's not a naturally strong-armed guy, and so if he has to develop arm strength or generate arm strength, he's going to have to he has to on the fly change how he throws. He has to deliberately put more energy behind a ball. He's the opposite of Matthew Stafford. And I haven't played quarterback before, but I would think that would have something to do with your consistency in ball placement. Is that if you have to change the way you throw to add velocity, you're going to lose some of your command. That just seems natural. He did get better over the course of the game in week one with ball placement, markedly better. So I think overall there's a lot of reason to be happy in Houston. But the last thing I'll do for my rapid fire, just because I've teased the quarterback thing, I'm not going to get into it. I'll just say who the third guy was, and then we'll have to talk about him another show. You already know who I'm going to say, because I emailed all the editors while I was watching the film of this guy, calling dibs on getting to be the one that writes the story, and I already got to do one story on him, but the guy was Carson Wentz. I'm over the moon about him.
Yeah?
And I'll tell you why the next show, or let's give it another week.
All right. I'm gonna mesh three of these in here real quick. Titans, I thought the Titans were hilarious in that last drive just because it took them so long to get down the field, and they're the only team where it's like, oh, they have 7 minutes. I don't know, can they go 70 yards in 7 minutes, or are they going to run out of time? And then of all things, it ends with Andre Johnson, of all people, making the game-winning catch on that, you know, just sort of massive humanity, and Andre Johnson comes up with it.
Speaking of not running out of time, right, Andre Johnson?
Exactly. Giants, bad situational football. It looked like last year again, where they're inside the five and just running. Whether it's Shane Vereen on those little like handoffs out of the shotgun, or Larry Donnell, or whoever else they throw to, they just don't get it right down there. And that's exactly what their problem was last year. But my favorite moment of that game, so Kobe Fleener, who I found his signing to be confusing in New Orleans, and we talked about it earlier, and I know he's the kind of big target that you want up the seam in a Drew Brees offense, but he's been a mess so far. His timing's all off. So many times the ball's come his way, he doesn't get his head around on time. It's just he's having major problems there, and on top of that, he's just not a big time, we're not talking about an Eric Ebron type of athlete or something like that. But there was a moment on one of these plays that almost turned into an interception, and they showed Brees right afterwards, and he just turns his head and he goes like, "Kobe," and all I could think was like Seinfeld saying Newman, and I hope that's like a recurring theme all year is just Drew Brees turning his head and being like, "Kobe."
It will if Fleener plays all year, and he'll have some good moments, but that will be a theme because that was his career in Indianapolis too.
Yep.
And we like Fleener at MMQB. He's done some projects with us.
We do. So I don't mean to bust on the guy, and he's got time to develop here, but
No, he doesn't. No, he is what he is at this point of his career.
He's got time to learn an offense, I'll say that.
They haven't asked him to be running those seam routes yet either, which is a little bit concerning because that's the guy, I think that's why they signed him.
Yep.
Are we doing these awards now? Because I want you to know we're at item 10, right? The awards?
We are.
I have not prepped one bit for this, and I really don't plan to at any week this year. You know how I feel about these awards.
That's, some of us take these awards more seriously than others. We are at topic 10. That is the weekly awards. Players of the week, coach of the week. All of these guys, I don't know, we should send them something? I don't know.
Whatever. No, come on.
Oh, you know what? If you are a player or a coach who gets one of these awards, you should go to mybookie.net, enter the promo code 10things, and you will get your discount. That's how it works. Go to mybookie.net because you're probably breaking some sort of rule with the NFL, but listeners, you can go there. All right. Topic 10, the awards. I'll go first. You went first in lightning round. I'll go first on offensive player, okay. And I'm going to split it between two senior citizen running backs. One is D'Angelo Williams, who was huge all day in the win over the Bengals, both as a runner and a receiver. He's creating a lot of yards that just wouldn't necessarily be there. On top of that, he's so reliable when he's asked to pick up blitzes, and he's such a safety valve out of the backfield, and as we said earlier in the show, he is going to split it with LeGarrette Blount, who closed out the Dolphins. We already did the whole Kira Sedgwick bit, so we won't repeat it.
But the closer.
Those are my guys.
I will go with Stephon Diggs for Minnesota. Kind of played a little bit like Antonio Brown Sunday night. Stylistically, very good command in and out of his breaks. Transitional quickness is off the charts. And he was great last season. He got quiet in the second half or towards the end of the year. He's exploded in the first 2 weeks of this season.
Yep. Defensive player of the week, I'm giving it to Von Miller. And I'm going to try and make this the only time this year I give it to Von Miller. But I think it just sort of makes sense timing-wise because we came out of the offseason and it was kind of like, maybe Khalil Mack overtakes him this year or something like that. And it's kind of like, nope, no one's overtaking him. Von Miller is the best coming off the edge, and he was unstoppable today. Sealed the game in Denver, one of his three sacks of Andrew Luck. And he's my guy, defensive player of the week.
Okay, I'll go with Patrick Peterson from Arizona. He's shadowed. He traveled with Mike Evans of Tampa Bay. He got beat for one touchdown. It was on a perfect back shoulder play. I think it was Tampa Bay's only touchdown, certainly their only meaningful touchdown. But the rest of the game, he owned Mike Evans. It dominated him and beat him for an interception early in the game, too. So Patrick Peterson, with that blitz scheme making its return now to Arizona after a one-week delay, taking out number one receivers and winning in man coverage, that's what that defense needs.
Special teams, players of the week, I'm giving it to two guys on the Ravens unit. All the Ravens can share it when I send your gift basket. But Justin Tucker gets it, best kicker in football, hit from 52, 49, and 47, if I remember correctly off the top of my head. That was 52, 49, and 41. And then Tavon Young runs back the block extra point, which was just kind of neat to see because
two points.
There you go. They got him on the board, and it was
a
game
that
the Browns were in field goal range at the end, and if that 2 points had been 1 point earlier, there you go.
Okay, this is when I said I don't prepare. It's this one I don't prepare for. The other ones I was aware of, Peterson and Diggs, but there was a blocked punt in the Packers Vikings game, wasn't there?
Yes.
All right, my guy is whoever blocked the punt.
Ty Montgomery. Ty Montgomery,
okay,
come on down.
That's who my guy is then.
Andy Benoit, special teams player of the week. Coach of the week, I'm splitting it to I'm giving it to Mike McCoy because we all sort of left the Chargers for dead, and then they showed up and just completely destroyed the Jaguars, who everyone loved 2 weeks ago and probably no longer do. And Josh McDaniels, because like I said, just watching that offense go today, first Garoppolo, and then even, they had it scaled back with the Brissett, but it just looks easy for whoever is in there at quarterback, and obviously Josh McDaniels has a lot to do with that.
All right, what's the point of doing these awards if you're going to keep splitting them?
It was just a very odd week.
No, it was. No, come on. No, because I'm going to do Josh McDaniels, I have nothing to say now. What's the point?
Well, there you go. You can
Josh
say what I just said verbatim.
Yeah, I was going to say Josh McDaniels for all the reasons you just said, and that's how we end the show, because you're hedging.
That's how you end it with a bang. All right, that's the show. You guys out there are the best. Thank you so much for listening to the Week 2 episode of the MMQB 10 Things podcast. We'd also like to thank our wonderful sponsor, MyBookie.net. I play there. You should too. Please support them the way they support our podcast. A quick thanks to our researcher, Jeff Irwin, and the talented folks at Digital Media who make us sound so good. Remember to listen and subscribe to new and archived episodes of the MMQB podcast with Albert Breer, the MMQB podcast with Peter King, and this podcast, the MMQB 10 Things podcast, wherever you listen to podcasts, including the MMQB.com, SI.com, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Play, and other podcast providers. We'll catch up with you next week.
This has been a Digital Media production. Find your voice.
Tip of the hat to Albert, another strong edition of MMQB. Did you know your favorite team has a daily podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network? Steelers fans, we have you covered with Locked On Steelers. Cowboys fans, it's Locked On Cowboys. And Chiefs fans, it's Locked On Chiefs. You get the picture. Search Locked On, your favorite team. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcasts Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.